to kill as many women I thought were prostitutes as I possibly could. I thought I could kill as many of them as I wanted without getting caught.
And Mr. Ridgeway, it's your desire to plead guilty to the 48 charges of aggravated murder in the first degree because you believe that you are guilty of each of those offenses.
Yes.
Like many other serial killers, Ridgeway targeted vulnerable people. And prostitutes are the most vulnerable of all.
Everybody was terrified. You know, I mean, these were places where we picnicked, where we swam, where children ran free up until this time when, you know, bodies start showing up. Once the killing started, everyone was rather mystified. I mean, is this the work of more than one person? And where does it begin and where does it end? And how could this be? I mean, they were all in the Green River.
We were told by a rafter that he'd been floating down the river. He saw two, what he thought were mannequins, alongside the riverbank. And as he got closer, realized that they weren't mannequins, but indeed they were human bodies. And one of her arms were free and waving in the water, saying to me, help, you know, here I am. It's an image in my mind that will never go away.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Now, today's episode is brought to you by HelloFresh. Please visit HelloFresh.com and use promo code TCB30 to save $30 off your first week of deliveries when you subscribe. Before we start the episode, I just thought we'd share with our listeners a little bit about our trip to California, where we did some research for a future episode on the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown. Now, we interviewed a couple of neighbors who knew Nicole and Ron, and we also took a tour called the OJ Tour through Brentwood, and we kind of got a feel of the geography and the culture in the area in the 1990s.
Yeah, this guy who took us around, Adam, grew up then.
Yeah, he was going to the elementary school down
right.
The street.
And he was fascinating. I mean, there's some good stories he had.
Well, he's been doing the tour since he was a teenager. It was actually a friend of his father who started doing the tour back in the 90s, not for money, but just because people were interested and wanted to see where things happened.
Yeah, well, it can't be for money because he didn't charge us very much.
No, but he only does it very part-time.
Yeah.
But I mean, he didn't do it for money at all. Adam did charge a little, and he took us around, and it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, we went to Rockingham, we went to Bundy Drive, and he had little stories he told us along the way.
Yeah, he was fascinating.
Yeah.
So sometime down the road, we're going to have that edition.
Yes, that's an episode sometime this summer, I hope, to get to that.
Might take more than one time.
Maybe. It's always a good, you know, there's never a bad reason to go to California. Always
no,
nice.
It might take more than one episode to do the O.J.
Simpson
case.
Oh, more than
case.
One episode. Yeah, yeah, that's true. It's pretty long.
It sure is.
If we want to go through the trial and everything, but it's fascinating to meet the people there and kind of get a feel for what it's like, because it's just like other people. I mean, it's kind of a fancy neighborhood, but really not as much as you'd think.
No.
No.
I mean, it was fancy enough.
Yeah, I'm sure. But it was pretty cool. We went by the junior high where they had the recital, you know, the famous recital where OJ and Nicole were watching their daughter before Nicole and her family went to dinner at Mezzaluna. We went to Mezzaluna, which is now actually a coffee shop. It's not there anymore. But we had fun.
We did.
Yeah.
Look for us down the road.
Yeah. So anyway, this episode, this is a dark episode.
It's more than dark.
Dark, very involved. It's been a rough week with this, hasn't it?
Oh.
It's really hard to delve yourself into this kind of horrible debauchery.
No, and I think this is our first serial killer. Am I right? Have we done any serial killers yet?
It might be. I'd have to think about it.
I mean, as far as I can remember.
I know we haven't done any of the really famous serial killers yet, so.
No, we haven't.
Yeah, it might be.
But I think this is our first one, so.
Well, I guess Son of Sam, our most recent one.
Oh, yeah.
Our commission podcast, that was a serial killer, so I guess we're in serial killer territory this month.
I guess I don't have a short-term memory.
Yeah, but you have the long-term, so that's good.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to just start talking about this Green River killer. Now, it was in the 1980s and 1990s, and at least 70 women, it was found out, were killed in the Seattle and Tacoma, Washington area by the Green River Killer. The victims were mainly prostitutes, some were runaways, who were picked up along the Pacific Highway South, International Boulevard 99. Now, the women were strangled, most of their bodies dumped into wooded areas around the Green River. The bodies were sometimes left in clusters, and some were posed, and almost all were nude. The task force assembled to find the Green River Killer, the largest since the Ted Bundy murders less than 10 years before this, included FBI profiler John Douglas and investigator Bob Keppel, who was known for his work on the Bundy case. So the involvement of the victims in prostitution absolutely complicated this case. Runaways and prostitutes were often not in close, regular contact with their families, making them less likely to be reported missing, and they would be reported after a lot more time had gone by, obviously.
Right, and a lot of these murders weren't reported missing.
No.
I mean, they found bodies and had no idea who they were.
Who they were. That's really sad. Now, the prostitutes working the strip in Seattle had a real distrust of the police as well, which complicated things.
It would.
They were less likely to go forward if someone acted strange, because they're doing something illegal. So in this episode of True Crime Brewery, we're going to try to bring to light the victims of this Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway, as we learn about the horrible and often gruesome crimes of this most prolific serial killer in history. So before we get to our beer review, though, let me just throw out some thanks to some 5-star reviewers.
Absolutely.
So thank you, Erica Whitney, KCDK62, Lilybill, Melanie 13, Bexanadu, Skeptoid Humanoid, Sarah 16 Marie, Shane Ramey, Massachusetts Fan, Jasmine P, Owned by Chickens, Shamrock's Mom, Flightless Bones, Buffy Montrose, Jennifer from Disaster Area, and of course, Mo True Crime.
Mo True, Mo Better.
Right. What have you got for a beer?
I have a beer called Old Woody, which is brewed by Fish Brewing Company in Olympia, Washington.
Okay.
So this is a beer style known as an old ale. And I picked this because it's a Washington beer, but also because old ales are one of my favorite styles.
Really?
They are just excellent beers. So these beers are also known as stock ales, and they're beers with a full malt body and plenty of character. 100 or more years ago, old ales were often transferred into vats to mature, and that's where the name came from, old ale.
Because they were maturing.
Because they got old.
Okay, just checking.
So the color can vary from a dark amber to a near black color. You can expect fruity tastes and aromas, raisins and currants primarily. They can taste wine-like. There's a lot of malt, maybe some sharp alcohol. Vintage varieties may have a low level of oxidation, which means you pour it and there's no head.
I see.
So they tend to be more still.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, we learned last week.
No, it isn't. So some of the famous ones besides Old Woody. Old Woody is not that famous, an old ale, outside of Washington. But Founders Brewing Company makes one called Curmudgeon.
I like that name.
It's a good name. An old stock ale from North Coast Brewing in California. And one of my personal favorites, Really Old Brown Dog from Smutty Nose Brewing right here in New England.
Yeah.
Those are all examples of old ales.
That's a good one. I like that one too.
They are good. So Old Woody, this one in particular, is kind of a reddish amber color. It has a small tan head with just a smidge of lacing, big caramel malt aroma, followed by some sweet fruit, big caramel taste, plums, raisins, and just a hint of some hop bitterness. Pretty mellow beer. Great beer to drink.
Then that's what we'll do. We'll drink it.
Okay. I'll open it up.
Okay. Yep. Go ahead. We're getting rid of the recorded opening, and we're doing the actual opening now. So
yeah.
Let's see how that goes.
The bartender said we could do this.
Yes.
It's working well, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yep, I can see a thin head. I can smell the caramel across the table here.
You like that?
I like it.
All right.
It's more organic. I like this. So let's take our snifters and our old Woody and head on down to the quiet end.
Okay.
Okay.
I was going to make a comment, but I'm going to forego that.
Yeah. Ridgway's first confirmed victim was 16-year-old Wendy Caulfield. Wendy was living with a foster family in Tacoma, Washington. The state had taken custody of Wendy because she and her mother argued all of the time, and her mother couldn't control her anymore.
It doesn't sound like the hugest reason to give her up.
Now, Wendy had recently served time in Tacoma's juvenile detention center, so maybe it was more serious than you're thinking.
So maybe she was, yeah, because I mean, if everybody with the teenagers said, I can't control this kid, they'd all be in foster care.
Right, right. Now, after her parents' divorce, she did live in several different apartment buildings with her mother, so her mother had some trouble supporting her and keeping it together on her own.
Yeah, sounds like.
And Wendy missed a lot of school. So Wendy got into a sexual relationship with a 21-year-old man in the apartment complex. And then Wendy's mom got involved with the same man. Now, when the boyfriend moved in, Wendy moved out. We really can't blame her for that. And she started sleeping in other apartments in the same complex. But soon, poor Wendy was being passed from man to man, without a real home of her own. And Wendy was depressed about her life. She felt unloved by her parents, and she was incapable of improving her situation. Now, Mrs. Powers, Wendy's foster mother, saw her last on July 8th. Wendy had told her that she was going out for a walk. Mrs. Powers told Wendy to be back by 6 p.m., but she never showed up. Mrs. Powers had filed a missing persons report on Wendy back in late June, before Wendy returned home 2 days later. So after Wendy didn't return this time on July 8th, she didn't bother to file another report because she already had one on file.
Right, and she probably figured in a day or two she'll show up.
Yeah, so this wasn't totally unusual, and that's part of the problem, is that these victims were not always that dependable to be showing up when you'd expect them because they had difficult lives.
Oh,
right?
They absolutely did.
To put it mildly. So she figured that Wendy would turn up in a few days, and investigators would learn that Wendy had occasionally worked as a prostitute, but she wasn't a regular worker on the strip. I guess she'd done it in times of desperation. It sounds like she was kind of selling her body in a way to have a place to live before that, going from apartment to apartment. So yeah. This is what she was relying on to take care of herself.
So if she needed some money or a place to stay, she'd prostitute herself.
It's really all she had to offer, I imagine, is what she felt like.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Obviously, her self-esteem wouldn't have been very good.
No.
In this lifestyle.
I don't know how many cases you're going to go through, but these all are going to have a familiar ring to them.
Yeah, and unfortunately, or, you know, whatever, we can't go through all of them. But these are good examples of the women, the young women, the girls, actually, a lot of them,
yeah,
that this happened to.
These are 14, 15, 16-year-olds.
Yeah.
Some older, but they're mostly teens.
Yeah, and they're mostly people who come from homes that just they couldn't stay in for one reason or another.
Right.
So they turn to prostitution out of desperation. They end up with drug habits often, and they have to support those. And it's just a really sad situation for all of these young women.
Oh, that doesn't begin to describe it.
Yeah. Now, on July 15th, 1982, two young boys bicycling along the Peck Bridge in Kent, King County, Washington, noticed an object floating below the bridge in the Green River. So they went to look closer, and they discovered Wendy's body. And it was caught along the pilings under the bridge. Now, Wendy was naked except for her shoes and her socks, and the rest of her clothing, jeans, underwear, and shirt, were knotted around her neck like a ligature. Now, an autopsy would confirm that Wendy had been strangled. She had a fractured hyoid bone and significant hemorrhaging in her neck muscles.
Right. For those not medically inclined, the hyoid bone is a bone that sits kind of above the larynx. It's a fairly slender bone.
And do you want to say where the larynx is then, if you're talking to people who aren't medically inclined?
Oh, I thought people would know where the larynx was. That's in the throat.
Yeah.
Or in the neck. So when you see a hyoid bone that's been crushed or broken, that almost always is going to indicate strangulation.
Right. So also her left humerus, her upper arm bone, was broken. And the condition of her body was consistent with death having occurred shortly after her disappearance back on July 8th. Now, beginning in 1982, dozens of young women like Wendy disappeared in King County. Some were murdered and dumped, often they were dumped in groups, and others were simply missing and their fates were unknown. Now, many of these victims were only teenagers, as we said. Most were involved in prostitution. Five women were strangled to death and left in or near the Green River in July and August of 1982, and all five of these women had a history of prostitution. Over the next several years, more victims were found. In many cases, months or even years passed between their disappearance and their discovery, and this left only skeletal remains to be found. Most of them had no clothing, no possessions, and identification sometimes took years. Now, Gary Ridgway, he was born on February 18, 1949, and his family moved to King County when he was only 11. His parents' house was actually less than 2 miles from the Pacific Highway South. He was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, to Mary Steinman and Thomas Ridgway, and he was raised with his two brothers, Gregory and Thomas Jr. Now, relatives had said that his childhood was troubled. His parents had some violent arguments, and his mother could be very verbally abusive. She would belittle Gary and embarrass him in front of other family members. And Gary had an IQ of 82, so that's on the low side.
That is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, I think below 70 is mentally deficient, somewhere in there.
Okay.
So he was, but 100 is the average.
Okay. So a little below average.
So an 80 makes you not the brightest person in the room.
But he did get away with these crimes for a long time, which is interesting.
He did.
Yeah. Now, he performed poorly in school, and he also had a habit of wetting the bed, which angered his mother. So later, Ridgway would say that he developed conflicting feelings of anger and sexual attraction towards his mother. As a preteen, he started hurting and killing animals, which you've mentioned before is a sign of a psychopath, someone who's going to be dangerous.
We've talked about that. That fire setting at an early age, those are big red flags.
Yeah. Now, can anything be done when you discover it, though? Therapy? Is that usually effective?
Well, therapy, yes. Effectiveness, undetermined.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, the earlier you can get therapy started, the better the outcome's going to be.
Well, it definitely shows a lack of empathy.
It's going to be difficult. This kid's like, what, a preteen?
Yeah.
And he's harming animals?
Yeah.
So he's probably already had some time acting that way.
Well, and he doesn't have the kind of family situation that's going to help with it either.
He doesn't have family support. So even if they had started, well, I'm just guessing, but if it had been recognized that there was some mental illness and started therapy, who knows, maybe the outcome would have been different.
Yeah.
But it would have been very difficult to treat something like this.
Sure. Well, he once put a family cat into a cooler and closed the lid, allowing the cat to suffer and suffocate. And he would admit that that gave him pleasure, to see that the cat had been scratching at the cooler and had died a torturous death, really. Now, when he was 16, he stabbed a 6-year-old child. So this was severe, but unfortunately he wasn't caught. The boy survived, but it was a really serious injury. He'd stabbed the boy through the rib cage and into the liver. And what he'd done is he'd been waiting behind the bushes for the boy. He led him into the woods, and he would later tell a psychiatrist that he'd wondered what it would feel like to kill someone. He admitted to being worried about being caught, but he didn't have any worries about the boy. He was actually hoping the boy would die before he had a chance to talk to authorities.
Yeah, and this was something that was planned. It wasn't a random act.
Right.
I mean, he was planning on harming somebody.
He was. And so that's scary.
Imagine if he got him in the liver. That's going to bleed like crazy.
That's a dangerous place. Yeah.
You can die.
Yes, you can. So this guy was a really sick fuck, wasn't he?
Well, yes.
Is that the appropriate word for him?
A sick fuck?
Yeah.
It's your term.
What would you call him?
I'd call him the same thing. He was really mentally unhinged. Very sick.
And mean.
Sadistic.
Yes. So he would talk after his capture about an abusive childhood, his awkwardness, and some sexual confusion. But many people don't have the best childhoods, and they don't become brutal serial murderers. So, in my opinion, this is an evil person. I don't have empathy for this person.
No. And there's, you know, the whole argument of nature versus nurture. But I really think that some people are born evil.
I think so. And, yeah, it seems that way.
And there's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah. Because plenty of kids grow up in awful homes and are good people.
Right.
So it can't be purely nurture.
No.
No.
It can't be.
So Ridgway was held back 2 grades in high school. So he graduated in 1969, and after he graduated, he worked at Kenworth Motor Truck Company for a short time. Then, in July of 1969, he joined the military. In August of 1970, he married his first wife, and while in the Navy, he spent time in the Philippines, and that's where he says he had sex with prostitutes for the first time. So in July of 1971, Ridgway was honorably discharged from the Navy, and he returned to King County. But while he was overseas, his wife had become involved with another man. So when he returned, she asked him for a divorce. So Ridgway would point to this as a time when he really started getting some hatred towards women, more than he had before. And he would later say that his wife became a whore while he was overseas.
Well, that's an easy excuse, isn't it?
I think so.
I mean, she wasn't with him in the Philippines. So even though they were married...
And he admits that he was sleeping
and
with prostitutes.
He was sleeping with prostitutes.
So why is she a whore when she becomes involved with someone?
I know.
So it's and a real double standard.
They didn't seem to have a close marriage. I mean, it didn't last that long. And when he returned from his stint in the Philippines and his service in the Navy, that was it for
yeah.
the marriage.
Right.
So anyway, in August of 71, about a month or so after he returned to the United States, he began working as a painter at Kenworth. He worked at the Kenworth plant located on East Marginal Way South, a few miles north of the stretch of Pacific Highway South, which is the place where he later picked up many of his victims. Then in 1972, he met his second wife, who he married in December of 73. During their marriage, they lived in different homes in Renton, Federal Way, and West Seattle. These are all in Washington, of course.
Yeah, so they lived together, but they moved from a couple different homes.
Right.
Yeah.
They even had a son together. He was born in September of 1975. So his second wife would later say that he enjoyed having sex outdoors and was interested in bondage. He'd often be gone in the evenings for long periods of time, sometimes returning dirty and wet. Those are kind of concerning things, aren't they?
Sure they are, but she didn't really know what was going on, and probably a certain amount of denial. It's
she
your husband.
She didn't want to know what was going on.
Sure.
During the latter years of their marriage, because this marriage foundered also,
yes,
he began coming home later more often without explanation. The wife said that Ridgway, while walking with her in the woods, liked to hide from her and creep up behind her and frighten her. He also liked to practice walking noiselessly.
So that's kind of creepy.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, both of those things.
Yeah.
He's practicing to be walking through the woods silently. That's kind of weird stuff anyway.
It is.
But then going away from her and trying to sneak up on her to scare her?
I wouldn't like that.
It wouldn't last too long with me.
No. And I think that actually excited him to frighten her. So that's a red flag, I would say.
Oh, there's no question it.
Yeah.
It got him going.
Yeah, right. Now, on at least one occasion, Ridgway choked her, and he was using a police chokehold with his arm around her neck, and the relationship started to go downhill.
So, holy shit.
I guess that would do it.
That would do it for me.
Yeah. So they separated in July of 1980, and she got custody of their son, but Ridgway did get the boy to stay with him every other weekend. So in November of 1981, Ridgway bought a house at 21859 32nd Place South in King County. Now, the house was just a few blocks from Pacific Highway South, and he would later admit that he killed dozens of women at that house, and he lived there alone until 1985. So in July 1982, Giselle Lovorn was 19 years old. She worked as a prostitute on Pacific Highway South. And on Saturday, July 17th, at around 11 a.m., Giselle left her apartment, telling her friend that she planned to turn several tricks and then would be back later. but she was never seen again.
I liked in the stuff we were reading, they called them dates.
Yes, that's what they called them. Do you want a date?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, 2 months later, on September 25th, 1982, Giselle's remains were found near an apple tree in a wooded area near South 200th Street and 18th Avenue South. This is an area where Giselle often took her Johns to have her dates. So Giselle had been strangled with a pair of men's socks that were still wrapped around her neck. Except for the ligature, there was no clothing on her body, but she still wore her jewelry. Her body was on her back, and her legs were flexed wide at the hip with her knees bent at a 90-degree angle, so she was posed that way, the police believed.
She certainly was. But are you going to mention that?
I don't know. Go ahead.
He would come back after the women were dead and have sex with dead bodies.
This is, like, the most disturbing part about this that I don't like to talk about.
Okay.
But I know we have to mention it, the necrophilia.
It's just...
it's horrific.
I mean, when you think of grisly crimes, that has to be one of the worst.
I think so. It's very disturbing.
So I'm thinking anytime they're describing a woman found on her back with her hips flexed and her knees flexed, he had been back to have post-death sex with them.
You're probably right. I didn't really think of that. But yeah, that's just dreadful.
Well, he admitted to it.
He did admit to doing that, yeah. Now, it was in 2003 that Ridgway admitted to killing Giselle. He said that he picked up Giselle on a Saturday night with his 7-year-old son in the truck. He said Giselle directed him to the spot for the date, and after he parked at the spot, he told his son to wait in the truck while he and Giselle went for a walk. So disturbing.
Yeah, his kids in the truck.
His kids in the truck. He then took Giselle out into a wooded area out of sight of his son, and he and Giselle had sex. Doggy style, which I heard was what he preferred so that he could strangle them from behind most
right.
of the time.
His interviews, he would come to a climax and the prostitute would lift up her head and that was the signal for him to put something around her neck and strangle her.
Yeah. And once he climaxed with Giselle, he told her that he thought he heard his son coming. So this was, as he planned, so she'd raise her head and look and expose her neck. So from behind her, he pinned her neck between his upper and lower arm, and he choked her until she stopped moving. Then he took off his socks, tied them together, and wrapped them around her neck. And what I read is this is something he started doing because after he strangled some of the women, a couple of them weren't dead and had started moving. So he put a ligature around their neck after he'd strangled them with his arm.
Yeah.
To make sure that they couldn't breathe and that they were actually deceased.
He was using that police chokehold type thing.
Yeah.
So you have to be from behind to do that.
Right.
So doggy style works.
Yeah.
And so does it work that you can get a ligature around their necks?
Yeah. Well, he used a stick to fashion a tourniquet from the socks, and then he twisted the stick, tightening the socks around her neck, until he was satisfied that she wouldn't regain consciousness. Now, he left this makeshift tourniquet on Giselle, and he put on his clothes and returned to the truck. And he said that his son asked him where the young woman was, and Ridgway said that she had lived nearby and decided to walk home. Then he drove his son back to his home. Now, the next day, Ridgway did return and moved her body a short distance to a more secluded area. He collected her clothes and tried to take the socks off her neck, but the socks were cinched so tightly that he couldn't remove them. And then he did, I don't want to go into detail, but he did have intercourse with the body.
Yes.
Which I hate to even mention.
Well, and he did that on more than one occasion.
He did.
Not with this particular body.
With many of them.
But with many of his victims, he engaged in postmortem sex.
He did. And that's a real sickness.
I can't even comprehend it.
No, let's not talk about it. He admitted that he returned to the body a third time as well. But he wasn't certain if he'd had intercourse with it again, because he said that sometimes he was deterred by advancing decomposition.
God.
I know. So sick. Now, in the early 80s, the Green River Killer Task Force recovered the remains of 6 women designated as victims of the Green River Killer along a short stretch of Star Lake Road in King County. The remains were found about 3 miles from where 5 other victims were discovered and these six women were murdered during a 10-month period from late August 1982 to mid-June 1983. All six were working as prostitutes at the time they disappeared, and five of the six were last seen along Pacific Highway South, where Ridgway would hunt for his victims. Now, the circumstances of the sixth woman's disappearance aren't known, but she'd previously been arrested for prostitution. And with the exception of a blouse found on one of the victim's remains, all of the victims were naked. No biological evidence could be developed, and all of the victims appeared to have been strangled. Not only was Star Lake secluded, but it was convenient to Ridgway's house and Pacific Highway South. Ridgway was familiar with the area, and his second wife actually reported that they used to go swimming in that lake when they were together.
Yeah, he knows his way around the place.
Absolutely.
So one of the victims was Terry Mulligan. She disappeared on August 29th, 1982. She was last seen at about 6 o'clock that day, 6 o'clock in the evening. She is living at the Moonrise Hotel at Pacific Highway South and 144th Street, and she is working as a prostitute. And this is a 16-year-old runaway.
So sad. 16, I mean, geez.
I know. Ridgway didn't work that day because it was Sunday. He was 2 hours late to work the next morning. On April 1st, 1984, so we're looking at like a year and a half or more from the time she disappeared, Terry's skeletal remains were found near the northern downhill end of Star Lake Road. A striped blouse with buttons was still around her neck and upper arms. The blouse matched a description of the one Terry was wearing when she was last seen, and her body appeared to be posed also. Ridgway later admitted that he killed Terry where he had killed and left Giselle Lovorn during the previous month. He said that two boys had seen him in the area with Terry, so he decided to dump her body elsewhere. He again admitted to returning to the body and have intercourse in this case. March 3rd, 1983, about 9 p.m., Alma Smith disappeared from the street outside the Red Lion Inn at 188th Street and Pacific Highway South.
Mm-hmm. Now, Alma, she was working as a prostitute with her roommate, who was her best friend. And a bystander told Alma's roommate that Alma had left with a man matching Ridgway's description in a blue pickup truck. Now, while Alma's roommate waited for her outside the Red Lion Inn, a man in a blue pickup truck parked in the lot. Now, he got out and tried to persuade her to date him. He asked about her blonde girlfriend, that was Alma, and this frightened her, and she refused to go with him, so eventually he did drive off.
Lucky her.
Now, in 1986, this roommate was shown a photographic lineup and picked a photo of Gary Ridgway as the person who looked like the man who had tried to pick her up the night that Alma disappeared.
So how was his picture in this photographic array?
Because they had some suspicions about him.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. Now, her idea of him, though, was not absolute. She said that she thought the man had longer hair and thinner lips. So in early 1987, she identified a photo of Ridgway's pickup truck as the one driven by the man she saw on the night Alma disappeared. But Ridgway, he didn't own a blue pickup truck at that time. But his brother, who lived nearby, owned a 1969 one-half-ton Dodge pickup truck that was painted turquoise blue. So Gary's girlfriend during that time confirmed that he used his brother's truck sometimes.
Well, there you go.
Now, another woman said that she knew one of Alma's regular tricks, who drove a red pickup with a white canopy, and Ridgway drove a maroon pickup with a white canopy. So in 1986, this woman picked Ridgway's photo out of a lineup shown to her by a detective.
So we have two people identifying him.
Yeah, but the first one wasn't a definite ID, so that
right.
caused some problems.
But it looked like him.
Yeah.
And the car looked like, or the truck looked like the truck.
Yes. Exactly.
And now you have another woman saying that's who it is.
Yes. Now, Alma Smith's remains, just a scattered skeleton, were discovered on April 2nd, 1984, in the woods alongside Star Lake Road. The remains were about 50 yards off the road, 200 yards from other victims that had been found. Now, Ridgway would later confess to killing Alma and dumping her body, and he would recall that he tried to pick up and kill two other women that night. So he picked up Alma at the Red Lion Inn and took her to his house where he killed her. Then he took her body to Star Lake. But he said that the murder of Alma Smith went so smoothly, He recalled she hadn't been incontinent when he strangled her, so he didn't have to put his bedding in the wash. And he said it took only an hour to pick her up, take her to his house, kill her, and dump her body, and then return again to the Red Lion Inn.
So he might as well try to kill another person.
That was his thought process. He said that things went so smoothly, he decided to kill another woman that same night. And he'd approached this roommate, the other woman at the Red Lion Inn, but thankfully she turned him away. So the last known victim left near Star Lake Road was Carrie Royce, and she was also the youngest that we know of. She was 15 years old. According to a friend of hers, Carrie worked a two-block area between South 144th Street and 142nd Street on Pacific Highway South. Now this area, it included the 7-Eleven, where according to witnesses in Ridgeway, he met Denise Bush before he murdered her. It's also the area of the bus stop where Sandra Gabbert was working when Ridgeway killed her less than 2 months before he murdered the 15-year-old Carrie. So also, Tina Thompson, Martina Authorly, Yvonne Antosh, and Kim Nelson were staying in motels in this area when they disappeared. So the sheer numbers of women is so upsetting and mind-boggling.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is just kind of the beginning.
Right.
I mean, he's responsible for many, many, many more.
But this was his area where he did the most, was this time period.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, he did continue.
Yeah, he even continued after he initially said he had stopped.
Well, sure. He lied quite a bit.
Yeah.
And then he did admit to doing it later. So who knows how many women he actually killed.
Right. Because again, you're looking at people that might never be reported as being missing.
Right, so there could be a lot more.
Yeah.
Now, while he was under surveillance in 1987, Ridgeway was observed cruising for prostitutes in the area. Carrie's remains were found on March 10, 1985, in a swampy area, about 50 yards downhill from Star Lake Road. Two acquaintances of Carrie reported to police that she had an odd experience in the spring of 1983 with a man who took her up to Snoqualmie Pass. Now, both of these people saw Carrie return from this trip in a pickup. One of them gave police a very detailed description of the truck, which resembles the pickup truck owned at that time by Ridgway's father. And there was a credit card receipt showing that Gary Ridgway bought gas for this truck in March of 1983. So, in 1983, Gary Ridgway came to the attention of the task force as a result of the disappearance of a young woman named Marie Malvar. A man reported that Ridgway's truck appeared similar to the one in which he had seen Marie on the night she disappeared. But the man's description of the driver was very general again, and Ridgway, he denied picking up Malvar, so there was no evidence to implicate him, and he was no longer pursued as a suspect at that point in 1983.
Right. He wasn't.
No.
But his name actually resurfaced several times as a possible Green River killer suspect. So it wasn't like he was flying below the radar, exactly.
No.
Cops were aware of him.
They were.
During the 1980s, task force detectives investigated Ridgway and interviewed him on many occasions. And he was cooperative for the most part. He admitted to dating prostitutes, including at least one of the missing victims. He admitted to assaulting one woman, Rebecca Gardguay, claiming that he struck her because she bit him. After one police interview, Ridgway passed a polygraph exam where he denied killing any of the women.
So that's interesting, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, we do know that some people can pass it.
I think if you're a psychopath, you could maybe have a better chance of passing it.
Right, because you don't have the normal reaction to lying. Right. Yeah.
So in April of 1987, the task force served a search warrant on Ridgway's house, his work locker, and his vehicles. They seized hundreds of items of evidence, including carpet fibers, ropes, paint samples, and plastic tarps. They submitted the items to the Washington State Patrol Crime Laboratory, which compared them to evidence found with the victims. Detectives obtained and analyzed Ridgway's financial records. None of the evidence collected linked Ridgway with any particular scene or victim. There was one item that was significant, though.
What was that?
And that was a saliva sample taken from Ridgway.
Okay. Well, I'd just like to take a little pause here to tell our listeners about our sponsor, HelloFresh. And what I decided to focus on today is the family aspect of HelloFresh. You know, raising a family's hard work, it can be even more difficult to keep the lines of communication open between partners, kids, and siblings. Now, one thing, though, that has proven invaluable, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, Dickie, is that strong parenting and family closeness can really be improved by sharing an evening meal together.
Right. Well, that's one of the things we ask when we do well-child visits.
Really?
How many times a week do you sit down as a family and have dinner?
Interesting. I didn't know that.
And that's a big marker.
So that's important.
It is.
I mean, it's a chance for everyone to get off of their devices that we're always on, share a meal, and most importantly, have some conversations between family members. So whether you're preparing the meal with a family member, or you're eating together, HelloFresh Meal Service promotes family interaction and closeness.
Absolutely.
So say HelloFresh and say hello to your family, is what I say, by trying the HelloFresh meals.
Right. See, that's a good idea.
Yeah, they're convenient, they're affordable, they're delicious. Also, HelloFresh has two dietitians on staff, so you can really feel good about the nutritional value of your food that you're eating, and you're sharing it with the people you love. So it's a step up from ordering a pizza and sitting together to eat it, because you can feel good about what you're feeding your family.
Exactly. Let me tell you a little story.
Okay, why don't you?
I think it's a wonderful thing. There's a thing I learned from HelloFresh in terms of how flexible they were. A couple of weeks ago, we were in California. As you mentioned, we were doing some research. But we were also visiting our daughter and her two children, her two boys.
Right, our little grandsons.
The grandsons. So what I did was I had our meals delivered to the California address.
Yep, you can do that.
Instead of here.
Sure.
So here they are. We had a great time sitting around the table eating a nutritious, great-tasting meal. Even the boys ate the warming cauliflower and lentil dal.
It was good.
It was great. Well, the older one is more adventuresome. He'll eat pretty much anything. The younger one even ate some.
He did.
I was amazed. So it took about a half hour to make, the usual, and our 10-year-old grandson helped prepare it. So we got to have a sit-down meal, but I also got to interact with him doing the meal prep.
And I think that's really cool for a man to be teaching a boy to cook, right? Very progressive. So he'll be able to cook for his girlfriends, for his friends, take care of himself. It's great. A lot of people don't teach their boys.
I just looked at it as a time to hang out with Benji.
It was that too.
So it had nice fresh veggies and some naan, which of course is bread. And who doesn't like bread?
I love bread.
So that was a great meal.
Yeah. Yep. So if you just go to HelloFresh and use the promo code TCB30, you can save $30 off your first week of deliveries when you subscribe. And that's a substantial savings. It's worth giving it a try. Because you aren't committed. You can cancel any time. You can take a break. You can stop. You know, you can choose the different packages, the classic, the family, or the veggie box. It's just really a great thing. So say HelloFresh and say, hello, family.
Hello, family. They really enjoyed it.
They did.
Maybe it's because we were playing with knives.
Let's hope not. Now, in March of 2001, Detective Tom Jensen submitted biological evidence of several victims for DNA typing. In September 2001, forensic scientist Beverly Himmick analyzed the vaginal swabs from victim Marcia Chapman. She discovered that a partial DNA profile on the swab was consistent with Ridgway's DNA profile, and pubic hairs from victim Opal Mills had a male DNA profile which matched Ridgway's as well. So about this same time, forensic scientist Gene C. Johnson analyzed the swab from victim Carol Christensen, and she found the DNA profile from sperm on the swab that was consistent with Ridgway's DNA. So this linked Ridgway to one dump site and one victim. Now, the King County Sheriff's Office made preparations for his arrest. They put together a multi-agency task force, and they started a review of the unsolved murders. So on November 16, 2001, Ridgway attempted to pick up an undercover King County Sheriff's officer who was posing as a prostitute on Pacific Highway South, and then he was arrested, but he was released later that day.
So while he was being interviewed at the King County Jail during this booking,
yes,
he requested that they not contact his wife.
Yeah, and that's when he made that comment about contact the task force. They know me or something, right?
They know me. They've talked to me.
He's kind of cocky about it almost. Yeah. It's so creepy.
So by this time, he was married to his third wife, who he met in 1985. And this wife, Judith, would say that he was a gentleman, pulling out her chair, opening doors for her. They married in 1988 and were married for 13 years when he was arrested. So finally, we get to this.
Well, you know, and what about this wife? I mean, she had a totally different idea of him than anybody else.
Yeah.
It's weird. They used to go garage sailing together, biking, and she just thought he was the most wonderful husband. She said that he made every day like a honeymoon.
Yeah, I wonder what she was really doing.
I don't know. But she also, she'd made a comment at one point after his sentencing that she felt like she'd saved some women by making him happy during that time period he killed less. And I thought, that's a very distasteful thing to say.
Well, isn't it?
I don't think she was the brightest bulb.
Well, she married him.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you can't say that everyone that marries a psychopath is not smart.
Sure, I can.
Okay. Go ahead. Okay. But anyway, I just found her kind of upsetting and disturbing, some of the things she said.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think she was looking the other way. I think she probably knew of his proclivities.
I don't know if I'd go that far. I mean, I think maybe she was naive.
Okay.
Maybe a certain amount of denial, but maybe. She even didn't believe it once he was arrested. She stood by
charitable.
Him. She stood by him until the sentencing, pretty much.
But she said, I saved some women.
Yeah, that I didn't like.
Exactly.
Also how she said that she was really the most upset when she found condoms and realized he'd had sex with other women. And he'd hurt her. It's like, well, that's like the least of your problems, I would think.
Definitely the least of her problems. Right. So on November 30th, 2001, police arrested Ridgway for murder as he was leaving work. On December 5th, he was charged with 4 counts of aggravated murder in the first degree for the murders of Carol Christensen, Cynthia Hines, Marcia Chapman, and Opal Mills. In 3 of the 4 counts, DNA evidence linked Ridgway to the victims. So they finally have something. The body of Cynthia Hines was found within several feet of 2 other victims, confirming that the same killer murdered her.
Hmm.
Over the next year, prosecutors and detectives carefully investigated the uncharged Green River cases for more forensic work and possible charges.
Mm-hmm. Now, investigators, they sent hundreds of items to public and private forensic labs for analysis. A private lab, Microtrace, reported finding tiny spheres of sprayed paint on the clothing of 2 of the victims, Wendy Caulfield and Deborah Estes.
Yeah, this was really cool.
So this was important.
Or cool in the sense of forensic evidence.
Right. The paint was identical to the specialized DuPont paint used at the Kenworth truck plant where Ridgway worked, so this made a connection.
And it was like the only place that made it or something? I mean, it was
very specialized.
It was very specialized.
It ruled out pretty much anywhere else, I believe.
Yeah.
So a total of 5 murdered women were left in or near the Green River within a 1-month period between July and August of 1982. And Wendy Caulfield was the first. And Ridgway had already been charged with killing the last 3 victims. So it was obvious that the same person who killed these 4 women had also killed Deborah Bonner, because her body was found in the Green River a few weeks after Wendy's, and only a few days before the other 3. So by April 2003, prosecutors and detectives had completed their review of all the cases potentially linked to the Green River killer. The only new evidence of significance was that Imran DuPont paint on the clothing, and they found that on several victims. So 42 Green River cases remained uncharged, and there was little circumstantial or physical evidence connecting Ridgway to any of them. So without a confession, cases would remain unsolved. So Gary Ridgway, he faced 7 counts of aggravated first-degree murder, and after the arraignment, his attorneys contacted the King County prosecuting attorney and asked if the prosecutor would forego seeking the death penalty in exchange for pleas of guilty to the charged murders and a number of additional cases. So at first, the prosecutor was against that. They thought, if anyone deserves the death penalty, this guy does, right?
Absolutely.
But eventually, they did decide to accept the plea because they talked to the victims' families, and he wouldn't be executed with the plea, but his convictions could not be appealed. He would spend life in prison, and some of these families would get answers.
Yeah.
Some of the bodies would be found because, that again, might never be found.
Hopefully he would identify people and the families would know what happened to their daughter.
Well, he identified places, but he really didn't have much of a memory for the women because they meant nothing to him.
But all they needed was a place, and they could track them back.
Right. Now, what about that book you read about how someone consulted Ted Bundy when they were looking for him?
Isn't this fascinating?
That was good, yeah.
So it turns out that Ted Bundy, who we all also know as a serial killer.
Right, and that was about a decade earlier that he was...
But he was a consultant to the Green River Task Force. There is a book about the killings called The River Man, Ted Bundy and I Hunt for the Green River Killer. This was written by Robert Keppel, a former King County homicide detective. And it gives an inside the investigation view of crimes that transfixed the Seattle area for two decades. Fascinating book. It was based on an unusual relationship that Keppel developed with Bundy, but it's just one of a countless head-shaking disclosures throughout the book.
Really?
He started to talk to Bundy in November of 1984 after getting a letter from Bundy.
So Bundy was the one that started this off.
Bundy approached him. Keppel said he was buried in paperwork, and he looked up to see one of his fellow detectives who had gotten a letter from a judge in Pierce County who wanted it delivered to the task force staff. It was a letter from a wannabe consultant, but it happened to come from a place in death row in Florida, and the sender was Theodore Robert Bundy.
I'm surprised he was allowed to do that, to send that out.
No kidding. This sounds like Hannibal Lecter.
That's what it reminds me of, right? They went to talk to him about a different murderer.
Right. So they had a series of meetings with Bundy, and he offered an unparalleled view into serial killers and his idea on how to catch them.
Yeah, so he changed the way they thought about pursuing this killer, didn't he?
Yeah. He's one of the things was to have a slasher film festival showing violent movies and watching whoever came to see the movie. Setting up surveillances.
But they didn't do that.
Because it turned out that Bundy often went back to the scenes of his crimes, picking up evidence in parking lots and so on.
Well, this guy certainly went back to the scenes of the crimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they also, Bundy called the whole business about when, where, and how the River Man abducted his victims. The front end process. What Ted called the back end was just the opposite. The sites were much less of a mystery. And offered us the best clues to try to catch our man. So I guess he helped out in figuring out the mind of the serial killer.
I see. Well, I guess that's helpful. I just have, you know, a little bit of trouble giving a serial killer any credit for anything, but I guess if he can be used to help save people, it's worth a shot.
Yeah, I mean, looking at that and reading the book, I'm not sure how absolutely helpful it was. It did give some insight, but I think that they were down that road anyway.
Right, right.
So.
Well, it was in June of 2003 that Ridgway agreed to give complete, truthful, and candid information about his crimes and answer all questions, including the existent and the precise locations of all the unrecovered victim remains. So Ridgway was extensively interviewed for 5 months, and detectives confronted him with all of the Green River murders and similar unsolved homicides. In all, Ridgway confessed to killing over 60 women in King County. He also led the police to places he left the bodies, and he would describe what he did there. Now, his memory for the locations surpassed all the information provided to his attorneys and the knowledge of the detectives who had worked on the case for decades. He identified several dump sites on cases that weren't even considered Green River cases. He had led the task force to numerous sites. Now, early in the interview process, Ridgway made many self-serving claims. He said that he had not planned to kill any of his victims. He claimed that he had killed in a rage when something about the encounter with the woman provoked him. He attributed his anger to a variety of causes, including work issues with women, his divorces, even poor sleep.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing whatever he can to minimize things.
Right. Also, his child support payments and the stress of that. He said that killing relieved his pressure from these problems. So eventually he did admit, though, that these claims were false, and he admitted that once he managed to get a woman, he would kill her regardless of how she acted or how he felt. He initially insisted that he had stopped killing in 1985 when he met his third wife, Judith. And as the interviews continued, though, he admitted to killing as recently as 2001, and that's right near the time that he was arrested. So Ridgway claimed that his memory of specific victims was poor. Some of this could be due to the sheer number of women he murdered, but also his inability to recall the women was also a product of his psychopathy. I mean, the women had no meaning to him as individual people. For him, they simply existed to meet his needs. He did, however, frequently remember the place where he left their bodies. He even remembered weather conditions, and he had a very good memory of the vehicle that he was using at the time. In fact, he really had an excellent memory of things that really meant something to him.
Right. I mean, that was spot on. He didn't look at the victims as anything other than objects.
Absolutely.
So there's no need to keep any memory of them.
Well, I mean, that's kind of how you'd have to be to do this, I guess, because there's no empathy whatsoever.
Right.
Now, during the interviews, Ridgway explained that his general methods of finding and killing his victims were the same. He acknowledged that he devoted a considerable amount of time and effort in finding his victims. He would spend hours before and after work driving through areas of prostitution, and he called these efforts patrolling. He claimed that he only killed street prostitutes. There may have been psychological reasons that explain why he chose to kill prostitutes, but police believe the principal reason was the ease with which the women could be victimized. Because these are women that are getting into cars with strangers, they have a distrust of the police, and they're just, you can't get much more vulnerable than this.
Oh, no question. I mean, his victims were marginalized people.
Right.
Like you said, may or may not be missed. Even if they were missed, they might not want to, friends and relatives might not want to speak to police. I mean, there's lots of
And even if they do, the police might say, well, she's a prostitute. She disappears every few weeks. Why should we look for her now?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But he claimed that he picked these young women because he believed the police wouldn't look as hard for them also.
Well, I think he was right.
Also, he claimed that because prostitutes were often on the move, it was more difficult for police to determine where and when they had been killed.
Again, he's correct.
Now, most of Ridgway's victims were teenagers, and Ridgway said that their relative innocence made them less likely to con him or take advantage of him in any way. So he was looking for the younger ones, actually.
Yeah, he was. He also liked that the teens were more pleading for their lives. That was something that he got off on. He made it clear that these were carefully planned, premeditated killings. He said, I always had it in my mind to kill them. He developed a number of ruses to gain the confidence of his victims. These methods enabled him to continue killing after the news of the Green River Killer had reached the streets.
Yeah,
so
I can see that.
So even with people being on the lookout, he had ways of getting around that.
Right, he did. Very manipulative. That's why I said the low IQ. It seems like he was pretty manipulative.
He was pretty devious.
Yeah.
So many young women Ridgway approached had asked him if he was the Green River Killer. He used his small stature to suggest that he couldn't be the killer because he's too little.
He was a very unassuming-looking man.
Right.
Right?
Pretty ordinary. He estimated that 50 women asked him if he was the Green River Killer. He never told any of them that he was, but he admitted telling a couple of his victims as he strangled them that he was going to kill them. Well, great.
Yeah, so he was honest at that point? Is that what he was trying to say? I don't understand the significance.
There is no significance.
Well, another ploy he used was he often offered them food, jobs, the use of his vehicle, and even security by offering to be a regular customer. So sometimes they suspected that he was an undercover police officer. And to allay these concerns, he carried beer with him in his truck. Now, even if conditions weren't right for the killing of a particular woman, like if he'd been seen by witnesses or something, he might give the woman a ride. And he saw this as an investment in the future because this would make him seem familiar and trustworthy the next time he came by.
Right. So next time I can get you without witnesses and kill you.
Right. Now, if a woman was afraid to go with him to a remote location, Ridgway would sometimes have sex with her, hoping to give her an increased sense of security for the time when he would pick her up alone and kill her. So he's planning ahead.
Yeah.
Now, a sickening way that Ridgway lulled his victims into trusting him was by using his son in a variety of ways.
Yeah, this is like a 7-8-year-old kid who's riding along with his father.
Yeah.
This is
horrible. He was different ages throughout, though, because this went on for years.
I know, but still.
Started when he was a baby.
He's got a little kid.
I know. So he had a picture of his son in his wallet, which he would open his wallet and they'd see the picture, and that would make them think, oh, he's a dad, he's not dangerous. He also would leave toys on the dashboard. And as we mentioned earlier, sometimes he even had the boy in the truck with him, as he did as he picked the girls up.
Right.
Now, he said he preferred to kill at his home, and when he managed to persuade a woman to come to his house, he would use his son's room to assure her that he wasn't dangerous. Now, when he took women to his house, he would also encourage them to use the bathroom before they had sex, because he didn't want them to soil the bedding as he killed them. And to solve the problem of being fought with as he killed the women, he began to tell them that if they stopped struggling, he would stop strangling them. And then once they would stop struggling, it was easier for him to just finish it off. Now, in 1986, the only known survivor of an attack by Ridgway described her experience to a task force detective. So this was Rebecca Guay, and she recalled how Ridgway took her into the woods and removed his clothing. And he didn't appear sexually aroused, but then he attacked her. She said his face looked white, clammy, and cold. His arms and everything was cold. He was a totally different person, and he kind of made me think that if he did kill me, since he wasn't interested in me sexually before that, he probably would have tried to have intercourse with me after I was dead. So that's pretty insightful, don't you think?
I think so.
She was pretty smart. Now, Ridgway had initially denied the necrophilia or having sex with deceased victims in his police interviews, but a few days into the interview process, he said he may have ejaculated after choking his victims to death. And then eventually he admitted to having post-mortem intercourse with some of the victims.
Right. He's given up a little bit at a time.
Yeah. Now, in fact, Ridgway's desire to have sex with a corpse was so strong that he engaged in some very risky behavior to follow through with that. He described a time when he drove back with a body with his son in the truck. And while his son slept in the truck, he got out and used the body about 30 feet away from the truck. So incredibly, he assured detectives that his son was a hard sleeper to kind of say, well, it was okay.
Yeah, right.
And he described his necrophilia as a matter of convenience as well. He went on to describe an episode when he killed a woman in the back of his truck, and then he drove to work. Went back out at lunchtime. Now, his behavior became even more risky. He would take jewelry off the victims, and he liked to leave it in the women's bathrooms at the Kenworth truck plant where he worked. He said it gave him a real thrill to think about the women at work wearing his victims' jewelry. So one reason investigators have given for Ridgway avoiding detection for so long was that he didn't fit popular preconceptions of a serial killer.
Right. He's not a loner. He's married. Mm-hmm. He has a child. He has a job.
Yeah. No violent criminal history.
Right.
And for all of his adult life, he was either married or had a steady girlfriend. And he had that job for 30 years.
Yeah.
Even after his 2001 arrest, co-workers, former girlfriends, and family members voiced sympathy for him and really doubted that he could be the killer. Like I said, his third wife didn't believe he'd done it. And there were other people in his life also.
Well, as far as we know, she didn't believe that he was the perpetrator.
Right.
But I think she might have had some inkling.
That something was going on.
But anyway, I mean, the fancy FBI profiler didn't look at him.
No, he didn't seem like he fit the type.
Right.
Now, his wife claimed that they had this perfect marriage.
Who, wife number three?
Yeah. And those that knew him, and those that thought they knew him best, really didn't know him at all. So, in fact, Ridgway deliberately cultivated the innocuous aspects of his personality. And he did this knowingly, right? So he was non-threatening, non-impressive in appearance. He had a meek demeanor, and he had a small stature. And this is how he conned his victims. He'd killed for 20 years before he was charged with any of these Green River murders. And he used the same non-threatening affect he used to lull his victims into complacency to avoid drawing attention from law enforcement. so Ridgway's psychopathy allowed him to pass the polygraph, which I found interesting. In 1984, he passed the polygraph exam, and he'd already killed multiple victims at that point. But he explained that he was completely relaxed when he took the test.
Yeah, easy to pass that test.
He had also placed false evidence at the dump sites, which were deliberately intended to mislead the police. He left cigarette butts and chewing gum that weren't his. He left hotel pamphlets and car rental documents at some of the sites where he left the bodies.
Yeah, so he's pretty devious in terms of trying to figure out ways to mislead people.
And I think he got a kick out of that. I think that's part of the thrill for him.
Right. And he also had another plan to mislead the task force by suggesting that the Green River Killer might be operating in Oregon. So what he did to throw off investigators, he drove to Portland with his son and the partial remains of Denise Bush, Shirley Sherrill, and another woman. He deposited the remains in Tigard outside Portland. While in Oregon, he left no record of the trip. He paid for cash for pretty much all his expenses, hoped that the remains would be found, and misdirected police. And it did work to some extent. But when the remains were found in 1985, one of the task force detectives went to investigate.
Right.
So Ridgway claimed that Wendy Cuffield was his first victim, but then described two or three incidents when he may have killed women in the 70s. He said he left these bodies in places where he expected them to be discovered. Because he never heard reports of these murders on the news, he concluded that those women had regained consciousness after he left.
But we don't know.
Well, I guess we don't know for sure, but if I'm a prostitute and I'm being choked by a guy and I don't get killed and I come to, I'm going to say something to the police.
Well, I did read about one woman who died, and her family believed it was a drug overdose because she was found laying outside, I'm not sure where, but she had a drug problem,
yeah.
And she died, and they believed it was a drug overdose, until later on they figured out that she was actually a victim of the Green River Killer. So they wouldn't necessarily know how these women had died.
So they didn't do an autopsy on that woman?
I don't think so. I think it was just thought to be a drug overdose.
Yeah, okay.
Now, a task force detective managed to locate the boy who Ridgway had stabbed when he was 16. So, living in California, the man confirmed Ridgway's account of the stabbing. He said he was 6 years old at the time he was in the first grade. He was playing near a wooded area close to his house and the school, and he was wearing a cowboy hat, cowboy boots, and a toy rifle. He was playing with a stick, and he was approached by the teenager who asked him if he wanted to build a fort. So he was led into the wooded area behind the school, and he was stabbed in his liver. He said he was bleeding profusely and that the teen seemed very pleased and was laughing really loud. The victim, fortunately, was taken by an ambulance to a hospital, and he had surgery and remained hospitalized for several weeks. And his assailant, of course, was never found, who now we know was Gary Ridgway. Now, in December of 2003, King County Superior Court Judge Richard Jones sentenced Ridgway to 48 life sentences with no possibility of parole, and he was also sentenced to an additional 10 years for tampering with evidence for each of the 48 victims, so that added another 480 years to his sentence. So there's no way he's getting out.
I guess not. And there's absolutely no chance of parole.
No. Now, he confessed to more confirmed murders than any other American serial killer. Over a five-month period, he had confessed to 48 murders, 42 of which were on the police's list of probable Green River Killer victims. In February of 2004, county prosecutors began to release the videotape records of Ridgway's confession. In one taped interview, he told investigators that he was responsible for murdering 71 victims. And then he also said that murdering these women had been his real career.
Well, yeah, it had been.
Yeah. In February of 2011, Ridgway confessed to the murder of a 49th woman, and this was based on new evidence. Prosecutors had originally declined to prosecute on this case because he wasn't able to give any conclusive evidence. This victim, Rebecca Marrero, was a 20-year-old mother, and she was last seen at a motel in 1982. And at the hearing for his 49th life sentence, Ridgway rose to apologize to Rebecca's sister. but she refused to listen to him. She said, shut up and sit down. So you go, girl.
Good for her.
Now, Ridgway was initially placed in solitary confinement at Washington State Penitentiary in January of 2004, and in 2005 he was transferred to a minimum medium security tank. Then in May of 2015, he was transferred to the USP Florence, and that's a high-security federal prison east of Cannon City, Colorado. But then in September of 2015, after a public plea, Ridgway was returned to Washington so he'd be easily accessible for open murder investigations because they believe that there'll be more to come.
Well, I would think.
Yeah.
I mean, somewhere between 40 and 70, right?
Yeah.
And probably more than 70?
Could be up to 90.
Wow.
From what I hear. But at his sentencing, there were actually several family members that made victim impact statements. And he really didn't have any reaction to any of them. There was one, though, I believe it was someone's brother, who was a religious man and offered Ridgway forgiveness. And that's the only time that Ridgway shed a tear, because it was in regards to him, not the women.
Yes.
Because he felt sorry for himself that no one else was forgiving him. So that's the only time he really showed any emotion after hearing all these stories from families who lost their daughters, their sisters, their mother, just horrible losses. No reaction.
Exactly.
So totally only cared about himself.
Yep.
Yeah. What else did he have to say about that?
Nothing. I'm just disgusted.
It is disgusting. So the worst serial killer in American history. And just this unassuming little man.
Seemingly unassuming.
Right, right. Disturbing.
Well, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's a great book if anyone wants more information, which offers more details on the victims, which is the important part to me. It's called Green River Running Red. It's by Anne Rule. She's a great true crime author. We've read many of her books.
We have.
So I did the audio version of that, and it was very good. I would recommend that to anyone who wants to find out more about this case.
It's fascinating.
Yep, definitely is.
And disgusting at the same time.
Well, many crimes are, and this is probably among the most disgusting of them, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I just like to remind people about Team Tigrabber. We're building up episodes in the premium members-only podcast feed. So if you want to join, just go to our website, tigrabber.com, and become a member. You can do it for as little as $2 a month, and you also get a little cool gift. And then every time there's a new episode for members-only, you'll have access to it. So that's a pretty good deal. Also, you can shop the brewery. We just got a new order of t-shirts in. We've got snifters. We've got the bottle opener, which Dick always uses. He loves the bottle opener.
Well,
fits right in your wallet.
I'm always opening bottles.
Yeah. We've got lots of cool stuff you can buy there. Also, you can support us by not spending anything extra by going to our website and clicking on Shop Amazon and support Team Tigrabber. You click on those words, it will take you right to Amazon. It's the same as when you go to Amazon in any other way. You make your purchases, go through your checkout, no extra cost, and we get a little tiny bit of money back, which helps support the podcast, helps us pay for things, especially beer, which is probably the most important thing.
Well, some of us might think so.
Yeah. Beer, trips to California a little bit. A very little bit of the trip, right?
Right.
Right. So thanks for listening, and we're going to get around to our feedback. We'll just have a little musical interlude, and then we'll get to your feedback.
So stay tuned.
Out the front door like a ghost into a fog where no one notices the contrast of white on white. And in between the moon and you, angels get a better view of the crumbling difference between wrong and right. Well, I walk in the air between the rain, through myself and back again, where says she's dying. Through the door I hear her crying. Why? I don't know. Round here we always stand up straight. Round here something radiates. Nashville with a suitcase in her hand. She says she'd like to meet a boy who looks like Elvis. And she walks along the edge of where the ocean meets the land, just like she's walking on a wire in a circus. She parks her car outside my house and takes her clothes off. Says she's close to understanding Jesus, and she knows she's more than just a little misunderstood. She has trouble acting normal when she's nervous.
Welcome to Feedback. What have we got, Dick?
We got a few things today.
All right.
I'm looking at this.
I'm starting to really enjoy feedback. It's one of my favorite parts of the podcast
well,
now.
Well, I think it's good to interact with people.
Sure.
So I have an email from Michelle, who has a case recommendation. She wants us to look into the Lillilid family murders. They're a young family of four, kidnapped and held for some time by four teenagers in the 1990s. This happened in East Tennessee. Three of the four family members were murdered, and the toddler's son was left for dead in a ditch. Two of the murderers are up for parole now. It's a riveting story. I would love to hear your take on it. Thank you, Michelle. Sounds good.
I've already got some information on that because I thought it sounded good, and
yeah. It'll
definitely be one of our episodes.
I'd like to find out how the survivor did.
Absolutely. That's right.
So.
Which would be an adult now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be interesting.
20-some years ago.
Right.
So, yeah, that'll be fun.
Okay. So that's in our list. And then I have another recommendation I'll mention from Carolyn. And she suggests a book and a case for True Crime Brewery. And it's by Anne Rule, the book. So that's why I wanted to mention it. It's called Dead by Sunset. It's a 1995 true crime book by Anne Rule. And it's based on the 1986 Oregon case of the murder of Cheryl Keaton. Now, she was found beaten to death inside her van on Sunset Highway, and the later conviction of her estranged husband, and his name was Brad Cunningham. So this book made the New York Times bestseller list in 1996. I thought that was interesting, and it sounds like a pretty good case. So I haven't looked into that one yet, but I do have an interest in it, so I thought I'd mention it and say thanks for recommending that, Carolyn.
Yeah. No, we can't thank people enough for their recommendations.
I know. I love them. We have a lot of them. So just be patient because we've got enough cases to get us through 2020. But that's okay. I'll still take more because you never know.
We have that many?
We have a lot of recommendations. People.
So that means we can pick and choose, right?
Of course. That's what we do.
Okay.
Or I do, I guess.
That's
you kind of do what I tell you to do, which is nice.
Yes. See? I'm your boy.
That's right.
My turn again. I have an email from Raphael. He has a comment on death by dentist and also a comment on our justice system.
Now, we read one from Raphael last week about sentencing. I thought it was pretty interesting. I believe he's from the Netherlands?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. What did Raphael say this time?
So, he's first about the dentist episode.
Death by dentist.
He had to laugh about this, recognizing the sound of the car, where you found it strange, and I said, well, I know it's your car when I hear you in the driveway.
Well, yeah, this was a neighbor that lived across the street from the Corbins, and he heard Bart Corbin's truck come in the middle of the night, and he knew it was his truck. I thought, that's just very foreign to me that you could tell whose truck it is. A truck's a truck.
So he said that you filed it away under non-important mail peculiarities.
True.
But he likes these little interactions. And then he goes on about our justice system and how we deal with psychopaths and others lacking in the conscious and empathy department. In theory, I think it's good to lock them away indefinitely and can only get out if a team of psychiatrists, professionals, and whatever deems it risk-free. So then he goes on to say, just after I'd written to you, two people were killed in a double homicide in Arnhem. Yeah, that is the Netherlands. Murderer turned out to be convicted of in one of the institutions. Apparently put on a good act and convinced the panel he was sane and harmless enough to spend a few hours a day outside the institution, which they did. First chance he got, he escaped from the supervisor, and within a month he had murdered two people.
Now that probably wouldn't happen in the U.S., so I guess that's one positive thing about our system.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I don't think our system would do that.
Well, he said before that in the Netherlands they're very into rehabilitation and not so much into punishment as we are.
Right. So, remains a problem and a question. Personally, though, if a criminal is proven to be capable of such extreme crimes, the safety of the public should always come first. So, that's his thoughts are that this person shouldn't have been released.
I would agree with that.
So, that's his take.
All right.
And I think we would agree with everything that Raphael has said in that.
Yeah, I really like, he puts a lot of thought into the stuff he sends us, and for the most part, I do agree with what he says. Now, I also have a recommendation. It's an email from Carmen Lugo, and she recommended The Murder of Brandy Hawkins Laurent in Mississippi. I didn't know if we'd done a Mississippi crime.
We haven't.
Okay, so this might be one to do. She said, it's a truly odd case out of Mississippi. Brandy Hawkins Laurent was reported missing in August of 2007. Her body was eventually found in a shallow grave in November of 2007, but not before her husband, Leo Laurent, sent the media and law enforcement on a bizarre goose chase. He faked blog posts under Brandy's account, saying she was leaving her kids behind and running away with another man, and fabricated tales of a drive-by shooting. He claimed two black men shot at him, but he had gunpowder stains on his shirt, even though he was supposedly shot at from a great distance. Investigators claimed it was impossible to have this kind of gunpowder residue from such a distance. The shell casings matched his own gun, which he claimed he forgot that he owned, and
I love that.
And no tire tracks were found at the scene when police arrived. So Leo, he was a soccer coach, and he tried to present himself as a leader in the community and an upstanding citizen. But after strongly proclaiming his innocence, Leo eventually admitted to strangling Brandy, putting her body in a trash can, loading their baby in the family van, and burying Brandy's body, but not before showing her body to her baby. So throw into the mix a girlfriend, claims of drug dealers, and a suspect that just couldn't stop talking to the media, and you have a truly wild and sad case. Carmen says she started following this case after seeing it on the local news and reading about it through Brandy's close friend, Andrea. So that's a friend of hers who's also a forensic investigator on the case. So she sent me 5 or 6 links about this case that I'm going to look into for a future episode.
Oh, let's do that.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
Sounds interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah. My turn. This is from Cindy via email in regards to last week's episode, Son of Sam.
Right.
So she wanted to mention Helter Skelter.
So this has to do with the satanic cult connection.
Right.
Of David Berkowitz. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think when I was discussing it, I said that it was really well researched, but a little far-fetched.
And so did she disagree with you on that?
I think she's trying to make the point that it might not be that far-fetched.
Okay. That's interesting.
The link she sent us was that, as far as it goes, Maury Terry's investigation, which was the book we quoted, ranks as a companion work to former L.A. District Attorney Vincent Bugliosi's excellent study of the Charles Manson satanic cult, Helter Skelter.
Now, is that what the movie was based on? There was a TV movie.
Correct.
Years and years ago. Okay.
So, by 1982, Terry had demonstrated that the still-active Son of Sam cult network was a regrouping of the networks involved in the Manson murders.
Huh.
See, and this... again, was really well researched, but I just thought there were too many.
Well, did he make connections with specific people between the two cases?
He did.
Okay. Well, then that might be valid.
It might be.
And you have that killing in California at Stanford. What year was that? Was that in between the two?
No, it was between the Manson murders and the Son of Sam murders.
Okay. So a lot of people see that as a connection.
Right.
Yeah, or an overlapping.
And she just Cindy just wanted to make us aware that there might be more of a connection between the satanic cult, the Son of Sam murders, the Charlie Manson murders.
No.
I think there is evidence, but it was tough for me to connect it all.
Okay, now, were the Manson murders, was that a satanic cult?
Yeah.
It was, okay. I don't know much about it. I know that Charles Manson led a group of young people, and it was about Satan.
It was.
And so this Helter Skelter was to just cause chaos, and we talked about what satanic cults' motivations are, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So.
But are there people who were in Manson's family that were in this other cult? Well, Berkowitz didn't mention names, really, so I guess you can't tell.
We don't know.
Okay.
There's second, third, and fourth degree relations as you look at the two episodes, two murders,
okay.
A series of murders that might be related. But it was tough for me to connect them all.
Right.
So maybe what we ought to do somewhere down the road is look at the Manson murders.
Well, maybe, but those always frightened me from my childhood.
Okay.
So I don't know if I can face that fear yet. We'll think about it.
We'll think about that.
Yeah, that was a big deal when I was little. That was in the media a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have one more feedback item. It's from Cassie Claire on YouTube, and she shared a link about Darlie Routier. Now, that was a pretty, it's one of our more popular cases we did, right? The mom in Texas.
Yeah.
She had three boys. She killed her two older boys while her husband and her infant son were upstairs.
Correct.
And she also made it look like she had been, someone right. had attempted to kill her. She had stab wounds.
The old stranger entering the house, killing people and stabbing the mother.
Right. And I think we came to the conclusion that she was guilty. But
right. But we also thought that her husband knew more than he led on
right.
to
we're
believe.
Very suspicious of her husband. And
we
this
were.
Is what this is about. Everyone wants to know who was behind the conspiracy of keeping the evidence against Darren, that's her husband, away from the jury. So this is, it's a letter to Darlie Routier from somebody who's done some investigating. And it's a long letter. I'm just going to read a couple of things I highlighted. It's Dear Darlie, and it's, what caught my attention was the behavior of your husband. I couldn't help but feel a chill when I watched him. They showed another short clip of him standing there with you, and you seemed to want to talk about your children and show that they still played a big part in your life, but I didn't see that in Darren. I saw a man who was terrified to look into the camera. I saw him glaring at you. This man didn't appear to show any feelings towards his children or to the tragedy that had affected his family. After your conviction, Darren couldn't stay away from the camera, though, and over I kept hearing him go into detail about that he did CPR on little Devin. So the two boys that were killed were Devin and Damon?
Yeah, some D name.
Yep. And it was absolutely sickening. I began to look into your case a lot closer. If my theory is wrong and I have misjudged your husband, then I will be the first person to admit it. But I believe I am right, and my full intentions are to make sure that this case is investigated properly, and all the evidence that was kept away from the jury has every opportunity to be investigated. So, through many years of research, I have come to the conclusion that Darren may have murdered Damon and Devin. And this is what brought me to the conclusion. So, one of the things that this writer said was that it appeared that Darlie's statements of what she said had happened appeared to be true, according to the 911 call and witness statements. I cannot say the same for Darren. It was the fact that Darren had lied about so many things that bothered me. What bothered me is what he lied about. His lies appeared to be implicating you in the crime rather than trying to prove your innocence. So he would say that he believed in Darlie's innocence, but maybe he wasn't really supporting her. And I've heard this from other investigators. It says that in the beginning you were on the couch and you'd fallen asleep facing away from the television set. Damon is lying close to you and Devin is sleeping by the TV facing away from you. And you first remember Damon touching your shoulder and saying, "Mommy." Then you look up and you see a man walking away from you and you yell out and sit up. Now the first indication is that we need to look more at Darren because the intruder you describe was not a stranger. First of all, he was not in a hurry to exit the home. He was fully aware of a second exit through the kitchen. And why didn't he just attack you and finish off Damon? An intruder wouldn't have left you or Damon in limbo. He would have made sure that you were dead, and he would have been concerned about DNA transfer. Also, the knife, Darren was asked about a hair belonging to him that was found on the murder weapon, which was a knife, and Darren responded to the comment by saying that his hair got on the knife when the knife had hit the utility room floor. And Darren explained that his DNA was found on the sock in the alley as well as the hair on the knife, because he changed his clothes in that utility room. So if you remember, there was a sock of Darren's found down an alleyway, or down the street a little bit. And
down a ways.
And what the prosecutor had said is that Darley put it there, a man's sock with blood on it, to try and say there was an intruder. But it was, in fact, Darren's sock. And they believe, it was interesting because what they believe was that Darren had that sock caught in his pants. You know how sometimes you put on pants from the wash and there's a sock stuck up in the leg?
Uh-huh.
And that maybe it fell out of his pants and he didn't know it because it had his and the boy's DNA on it. Now, when police got there, he had no socks on his feet, but a sock that had recently been worn was found in the alley because it was a dirty sock. So that was one thing that she thought was suspicious about Darren. Also, the 911 call confirms that Darley is moving and talking to Damon several times. And for the first 3 minutes, you appear to be moving back and forth. Now, prosecutors had said that Darley was setting up the crime scene, and that's why she was moving back and forth. But this person thinks that it was because of Darren's behavior, because they heard Darren say something, and then he goes upstairs, and Darren claims that just before he goes upstairs, he checks Damon's pulse. But he never turned Damon over, so there's no proof that he even checked on Damon. Darren claimed that he didn't stop and help Damon because he had no pulse, but we know for a fact that that's not true, because Damon lived for over 6 minutes after the paramedics came. Now, Darren later changed his testimony that said he didn't help Damon because his CPR training taught him not to roll him over. But when the medics got there, the first thing they did was roll him over. So what do you think about, should you roll someone over?
Well, yeah, you can't perform CPR from the back.
Right, but you've always got that worried about a neck injury.
Oh, please. There's stab wounds. There's blood all over the place. You roll them over and do CPR.
Okay. That's what I thought. So not only that, but after the detective entered the home, he asked Darren to go over and assist Damon, and Darren didn't do that. Darren went right back over to Devin, and he did this horrific CPR on him where he said that air was splurting out of his chest.
Right.
So he doesn't know why he did that. That was suspicious. Also, Darren claimed that when police entered the home, he instructed them to help Damon, but this is also not true. Darren is heard on the 911 call, only trying to convince the officer that the intruder ran. Darren never searched for the intruder, and he never asked why this had happened. So the morning of June 6th, the dog didn't bark at all. That's another thing she finds suspicious, because if it had been Darren who lived there, then the dog wouldn't have barked, but if it had been an intruder, the dog should have been barking. It was a little yappy dog, a Pomeranian. So the person who wrote this letter owns a Pomeranian and says that she knows that the dog would bark. Now, I think there's a lot of factors that go into whether or not the dog would bark. But according to this person, it was a dog that barked pretty often whenever anyone came by.
Oh, sure.
It was a good watchdog.
But if the perpetrator was Darley, the dog wouldn't bark either.
True story. Now, in Darren's original statement, he said that he heard a sound, and that's what woke him up. He said that he was woken by the sound of glass breaking, and then he heard Darley screaming. But this would have been impossible. It's a 3,600-square-foot home, and he's on the second floor at the other end of the house. He didn't hear the baby crying or the dog barking, but he said he heard breaking glass. So why
couldn't he hear that? Or the screaming? I think.
Well, the screaming, yes, but he's saying he heard the breaking glass. The writer's saying he wouldn't have heard that from upstairs, so that maybe he was down there doing it, which I kind of feel like maybe he was in on it or something, but I don't think he did it on his own.
No.
No. But also, another thing brought up in the letter is that Darren was in a great deal of debt, and he was seeing that he might lose his business, and he was concerned as well with his personal image. And that Darley was the one being accused of being materialistic and selfish. But if you look at the interviews, Darren was really the one that seemed selfish and to care about himself, and Darley did seem to care about her children. There was never any effort from Darren to try and find the intruder. Darren never looked for the intruder. He never asked why the intruder was there. He never came forward about his plans for the home robbery. Remember, he'd been asking people to do a robbery so he'd collect insurance money.
Right.
And also Darley's mother, she claims may have been in on it because she never came forward even though she knew about those plans. There was Darren's failing the polygraph, and he lashed out at the man behind the polygraph that he failed, and he said the results were meaningless. He also said that he was being pressured and manipulated, and that he was manipulated into telling lies on the polygraph, and that he failed all of the important questions. Why wasn't that looked at by police as him having something to do with this? Another thing is that her family prevented people from posting information about her case unless it doesn't implicate Darren. I do remember that from the episode where she wasn't allowed to defend herself by implicating Darren by her defense team. Remember that?
I do.
Yeah.
But I gotta say that if she's innocent and he's the one who did the killing, I'd sing like a bird.
What do you mean? If you were who?
If I were Darley.
Sure, but no one's listening to her anymore because she's found guilty.
I'd still be chirping away.
Yeah. Also, Darren has done many interviews and he has many different versions of the story. Each time he hears something new about the case, he manages to fit his movements into whatever happened and try and get attention. They also said they had no forensic evidence pointing to Darren, but this writer says that's not true. They had blood on Darren's pants that pointed to him. They had a lot of evidence pointing to Darren. And if Darren's parents hadn't befriended Darley's mother, then Darley's mother would have spoke up, but she didn't. She took Darren's side. So
okay,
it's like a 6-page letter, but those are the highlights.
I could just say, wow. I mean, as I recall, the evidence was pretty strong that Darley did it.
Yeah, I think I really felt that Darley did it and maybe Darren was covering up for her.
Darren's complicit in this.
He may have been complicit because this whole thing about having his house robbed, that was suspicious to me, although it could be unrelated. I don't know.
But I don't think, I have to say, I don't agree with much, or I think there's alternative explanations. Maybe,
sure.
Maybe not alternative truths.
Well, one other thing brought up was this whole, which other listeners have written in about this, is the silly string video at the gravesite. If this was used to prosecute her and find her guilty, that's wrong, and I agree.
Yeah.
Everyone behaves differently when they have a loss. It looks weird to me, but I certainly wouldn't hold that against her.
There was some really nice forensics work that showed exactly how it got committed.
Yeah, well, you could really see that on the Forensic Files episode, although I will say there are many cases I've done where I've watched Forensic Files, and they always make the person look really guilty.
Okay.
They don't seem to cover both sides. They're very much into saying that person was guilty.
I think there's still a lot of ambiguity in terms of the information that the writers provided.
Sure.
So,
but this person's put some time into it, so I thought it was worth bringing up.
Oh, it's still an interesting case.
It is an interesting case.
I'm firmly in the
I don't understand why she would kill those two kids.
Who?
Darley. Why would she do that? Did we ever really have a motive for her?
I thought the motive was that they'd be better off without the kids.
Financially?
Financially.
I guess, but that's a mother to kill her kids, that's pretty out there.
Yeah.
And the baby wasn't harmed.
But I would still, if she knows that her husband killed the kids, I'd be blaming him all over the place.
True. Well, you know, there was a follow-up investigation of people that volunteered to help her on death row. I forget what station this was on or something, but this was a documentary. And what they had said is that they found Darren suspicious, and they had a lot of evidence that they wanted brought against Darren. But that really couldn't be done because she was convicted, and nobody was really going to listen to that because there was still a lot making her look guilty is the problem.
Well, I
think she can't be exonerated.
And I think for sure that he was more involved than he claims to be.
Well, he said weird things. Remember he told the police when they came something about her breasts?
Yeah.
How hot she is or something?
Yeah. And
that's not normal.
He just has too many things that make him suspicious. But
unless he was just generally a piece of crap and she killed the kids, that's a total possibility.
Well, that's the possibility I'm going to go with.
Yeah. That might be the most true thing in my mind as well.
Okay. Good feedback.
Talk to everybody in a week.
See you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Enjoy the day.